Now, people in our world are looking for something to believe in. You believe that? That's a tricky question, isn't it? People are looking for something to believe in. I don't care who you are. I don't care what your background is. I don't care what your ethnicity is or your race is or whatever. Everybody is looking for something to believe in. Sigmund Freud, and this will probably be the only Sigmund Freud quote you'll ever hear out of my mouth. But even a blind hog can find an acorn every now and then, right? Sigmund Freud said, if there was no God, man would have invented him because of his need for him. People are searching. They need something to believe in. As much of our culture moves away from religious faith, people still look for something to believe in. Think about it. Think about everyone needs a cause, something to believe in, to go after. There is a ribbon. There's a ribbon for every cause, isn't there? As many as there are colors and combinations of colors that you can put together, they've made a ribbon for it. And people wear them. And that's what they believe in. That's their cause that they're throwing themselves behind. And we're no way denigrating any of those causes. Those causes, many of them are very good. But it is something that we believe in. It's something that we want to give ourselves to some degree. And so everybody's searching for that. You know, some people have a strong belief in regard to the protection of our environment, right? All of these, we can talk about, extremism. There's extremes in almost anything. And so there's extremism in these things, but there's also, aspects of it that is logical and needful. There are people that are given and believe in the protection of the environment. There are people that have a passionate desire to protect animals from any kind of harm. You think about people like those that participate in PETA, and it's not what Tom's shirt says it means. People for eating tasty animals, that's not what that means. But those people believe in that, and they're passionate about it, aren't they? You think about some people have a strong devotion to a particular political ideology, right? Now, I think we all have a particular political ideology. We all kind of participate in that in some way, but some people are very strong in it, right? But they're you're going to hear it every time you get around them, and that's going to be what they're all about. They believe in it with all of their heart, and they're given to that particular ideology. Some have a belief in themselves, so you're going to believe in something, but you can't believe in yourself. You can believe, and I don't mean that in a good way necessarily. I'm talking about a belief in yourself to where it leads them to seek success and acclaim for themselves above all else. It's all about them, and they'll step on anybody, walk on anybody, but they believe that that's what they need in this life. Some people have an idea that a world without Christianity or religion in general would be a better place, and they believe that for whatever their reasons may be. Some have a drive to advocate and promote beliefs like evolution and Big Bang origins. There are so many, yet they are all about people believing in something. Now, some of these beliefs and some of these things that we see people believing in are worth believing in, right? And some of these things are not. But yet, everybody's looking to believe. Belief is, in the end, what drives us forward. It is a hope for something better. That's why people believe. If you're wanting to protect the environment, your belief is that we can make the environment, safer and better and cleaner, right? You believe in something better. There's something better out there in the future. And if I give myself to it, I can help people accomplish it, whatever it may be. But it drives us forward. People who feel they have no purpose or no future, they often become hopeless. They become sad. There's nothing better. There's nothing beyond where I'm at right now. And so, what is the point? And their future becomes quite hopeless and sad. Why struggle? Why work hard? Why endure life if there is nothing better in the future? If that work that I am committed to and those struggles that I go through serve no purpose, then what is the purpose? So we can kind of see, right, why belief is so important to people. A belief in something. And so people seek it out every day. What about Christianity? You know, when we think about the question, what is worth believing in? What beliefs have the biggest impact in my life and on lives of others? What kind of effect does a particular belief have on the world? We have to consider Christianity, don't we? I mean, any belief you have, I think you kind of weigh that. What's this effect going to have on people? Is this going to better society? Is this going to better the world? But what is it going to have, the impact? So as we think about Christianity, what kind of effect has it had on the world? Now, one of my favorite movies, and I don't know how many times I've seen it, because I as far back as I can remember watching it, is It's a Wonderful Life, right? You know, George Bailey, who says he'd be better off dead, right? It'd be better if he'd never been born. Old Clarence, the goofy angel. You know, I always laugh when he says, you look like the kind of angel I get. He says, okay, you've never been born. And George then, the rest of the movie, gets to see what the town of Bedford Falls, or Potterville after he was not born, the town of Bedford Falls was like as a result of his not ever having been born. Saw his family and his wife and so many other things change. You know, what would the world be like, though, if Christ had never been born? And I'm not talking about this from a standpoint. I mean, I know there's the quick and easy answer for by the Christian that nobody would be saved. Okay, we're going to set that one aside. That's the big one. That's the obvious one in the room, that no one could be saved if Jesus Christ had never been born. We'd all be lost. I understand that. But we're going to set that one aside. We want to look at more of the aspect of the world in general. What kind of world would we live in if Jesus Christ had never been born? Well, there are some things that are obvious to us. Not so important, but obvious. All time is dated by Jesus Christ, right? You know, A.D., Anno Domini, means the year of our Lord. B.C. means before Christ, right? Now, there are efforts today to change that to a dating system called the Common Era and before Common Era. But, you know, it's amazing to me. That's all in an effort just to get Christ out of it, because it's still based on the exact same standard. It still begins in the same year before Common Era. BCE now is still BC, same time frame. You know, CE is now just what AD is. It's just, you know, they've gotten the name out, but it's still based on his birth, his life, and everything flows in two directions from there. So, you know, we'd have a different method of dating, for certain. Well, we'd also have fewer holidays, wouldn't we? No more Easter. No more, you know, you just have, you know, some of the things that we eat at Easter would just be yucky now, because there's no significance to it in our minds. No more Christmas. You know, and so there goes the fruitcake industry, right? Because who eats fruitcake except at Christmas? You know, it'll be gone for forever. No more Christmas bonuses, y'all. And I know you count on those things, but you don't get any more of those if Jesus Christ was never born. No more Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving, see, a lot of people don't realize Thanksgiving was instituted all the way back with George Washington, as he proclaimed a day of Thanksgiving to give in prayer to God. His Thanksgiving proclamation. You can see them from presidents going all the way back to the founding of our country, them establishing days for the Americans to give themselves to prayer and thanksgiving to God. So no more football and turkey on a Thursday in November, right? Because those things, there would be no reason to do that. Well, all those things had their origins in Christianity. But let's look at some things that are of greater importance. Things that maybe have a little bigger impact than Thanksgiving and Christmas and the way we date our time. Consider charity and compassion for just a moment. One aspect of that is hospitals and medical aid organizations based on Christian teachings. Christian people and people that have believed in Christian teachings or Christian compassion have been helping the sick for centuries. So many sick have been helped by people who were trying to show that compassion that Jesus Christ had for the suffering. People have went far and wide across this world to help sick people simply because they had that same love that Jesus Christ had for sick and hurting people. Jesus had great compassion on the sick. Matthew chapter 14 and verse 14. It says that when he had come ashore, he saw a large crowd and felt compassion for them and healed their sick. It's not the only time in which that kind of statement is made. Oftentimes Jesus came up on them and it said that he had compassion on them. He saw their sick and he just healed them all. Now, it's not real clear if he just kind of did that in one broad sweeping stroke, which he could have, or whether he did that individually. Jesus was kind of a hands-on individual guy. Maybe it probably was a little bit individual. But he cared. And while the miracles served the purpose of proving who he was, they were an expression of his compassion to those people. He wanted to help. And he did what he could. And what Jesus could do was far above what any other man could do for those that were hurting and sick. But I guess the primary story that we think about oftentimes when we think about these kind of things is the Good Samaritan, right? Now we often forget, we know the story, but we often forget why Jesus told the story. He was telling the story in response to a question that was actually asked as a follow-up to a bigger question. Open your Bibles to Luke chapter 10. Excuse me. Luke chapter 10. Beginning back in verse 25, you'll see the heading is for the Good Samaritan is down around verse 30. But verse 25, he's, and a lawyer stood up and put him to the test, saying, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" Now we know this passage. This is the greatest commandment, right? Another place he says, "What is the greatest commandment?" And Jesus answers with these same things. He said to him, "What is written in the law? How does it read to you?" And the lawyer answered, I mean, here's an expert in the law. He says, you know, basically, you know the law, you tell me. And the man says, "And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And Jesus said to him, "You have answered correctly. Do this, and you will live." But wishing to justify himself, did you catch that? So, he understands that he's not really doing that. This guy gets that, right? I don't care how dishonest we are with ourselves in our heart of hearts, we know where we're at. And we can say whatever we want to say, but we know where we are. And this guy, as righteous as he would try to portray himself as being a lawyer of God's law, so to speak, he knew exactly where he was at. And so he tries to justify himself. He's going to try to make excuse for himself here by asking this question. He says, "Who is my neighbor?" See, he's looking for the out, right? So if somebody's not something, I don't have to be loving to them. So he's looking for an out. Jesus replied and said, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among robbers. And they stripped him and beat him and went away, leaving him half dead. And by chance, a priest was going down on that road. And when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. Likewise, a Levite also, when he came to the place and saw, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, who was on a journey, came upon him, and when he saw him, he felt compassion, and came to him and bandaged up his wounds, pouring oil and wine on them. And he put him on his own beast and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And on the next day, he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper and said, 'Take care of him, and whatever more you spend, when I return, I will repay you.' Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell into the robber's hands?" And the lawyer said, "The one who showed mercy toward him." Jesus said to him, "Go and do the same." See, the problem was for this man is that everybody should be. He should be the Samaritan. Now, that's asking a lot of a Jew, right? You know, he's just shamed them by saying, you know, you're looking for every reason like the Levite and the priest, religious people. You're looking for every reason not to help because you don't want to help. And see, that's what he's doing. He's looking for a reason not to help, right? They passed by on the other side. You know, they might have justified themselves, well, this could all be a trap, because that's how they sometimes caught people, right? They'd make somebody look like they were injured. You walk over to help them, they clunk you on the head. So they probably justified it in their mind, right? Just like this man was trying to justify it. Jesus said, "You go and do the same. You be like the Samaritan. Everybody's your neighbor. Everybody's someone that you should help." And so, you know, the story is powerful when we look at it in the view of what Jesus Christ is asking us to do. But there's no one that we should look at and somehow justify ourselves from ignoring them or not caring about them or not loving them in some particular way. I mean, a Samaritan to a Jew was something less than a dog. And this is not the first time or the last time that Jesus is going to talk about Samaritans and compare them to Jews, right? Because he understands that they need to understand that even the Samaritan needs their attention. That, you know, these people that you look down upon, they can be more compassionate than maybe you are. You know, the two commandments here that Jesus is trying to enjoin, this love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. Another location of the same account, Jesus says the whole of the law and prophets hang on these two things. Everything hangs on them. So the Levite and the priest, yeah, they probably got the heart, soul, mind, and strength part. They somewhat were committed to God, but they weren't committed to people, were they? 1 John chapter 4 in the last verse says that how can you love God whom you have not seen if you cannot love who? Your brother whom you have seen. You know, Jesus is saying here basically you can't love God and not love man. And if we love man, we have to care about man. We have to care about man like Jesus Christ cared about man. Have compassion upon man. Now ultimately that love plays out in the spiritual realm most importantly, but it plays out in all realms as well for us. So Jesus told them in this particular situation to go and to do the same. And, you know, people have over the centuries done that, haven't they? They have been good Samaritans. We even have an organization. There was an organization down in Texas that called the Good Samaritan Group. And that's what they did. They went out and dug wells for villages and things. I mean, they were doing things to help people better, you know, in their physical lives. But, you know, it was a kindness. And it's the same kind of people that God calls us to individually be. Those and other teachings in the Bible have led people to hold the hands of those dying with terrible disease. You know, to hold the hand of a leper. To hold the hand of somebody with AIDS. And to comfort them. It has led people to brave war zones. To treat children that have been tragically injured. To literally go put their lives in peril so that they can take a child that's had his leg blown off by a mine and try to treat him and get him back to some kind of life that he can live. Christians have done that. How many countless people have died, would have died rather, if not for the efforts of people showing Christian compassion through medical care? And that's because Christ lived. How many people would have died alone and with no comfort because no one with Christian love held their hand as they breathed their last? Over the centuries since Christ has walked this earth. A lack of such love and compassion that Christ taught would make the history of this world a much darker thing. But Christians have brought light. And people practicing Christian beliefs have brought light to these terrible situations. You know, there have also been billions upon billions of dollars, or the equivalent of dollars, before dollars came around, right? Of aid given by Christians. This goes all the way back to the book of Acts, doesn't it? When the churches were giving to help the needy saints in Palestine, right? So this goes all the way back. And it has been a constant throughout that Christians were giving people, that they would give of their money to help people and be generous and benevolent. America has been probably the greatest charitable force this world has ever seen. America has probably given more, its people, and I'm not talking about the government, I'm talking about its people, has probably given more than all of charity in history. And there's a reason for that. It's not because we're Americans that, you know, as written in the Constitution, Americans must give charitably. It's not written in the Constitution or in the Declaration of Independence or any other founding document. It's written in people's hearts. You know why America has been so charitable and so giving? Because America was founded in Christian principle. Christian principle of love, care, love for your neighbor, love for those suffering. And that is why we became and have been the most giving nation on this earth. Well, I think that has more to do with us going in and trying to fix things that maybe we, you know, however you want to believe on that. But I think that has more to do with us going into nations and trying to fix them when maybe they don't want to be fixed. But, I think we have been seeing, I mean, you think about it, Dean, think about the earthquakes, think about the tsunami a few years back that killed over 250,000 people, and the amount of money that America gave and the billions that was given by American citizens to help those people. To be on the ground there at the very moment. You know, Christians were there. America is there with unbelievable amount of donated cash and supply anytime something happens. That is our heritage. That is a Christian heritage, though, ultimately. But because we've been a nation that was so profoundly Christian for so long, that has become an American heritage as well. That we're there. We go. You don't see the other nations coming with the support that America comes with to these nations out there. They may send some, but it doesn't even begin to approach what we do individually and through our churches and what the government does along with that. You know, Christian friends of mine were on the ground in India within literally a couple of days of that tsunami washing up on that shore and washing people away. They were on the shore with money, thousands and thousands of dollars of money to help and food and relief. I mean, it was that quick that Christians mobilized to be there on the ground and to help those people that were suffering. You know, I think back to personal experience in Miami, Oklahoma, hit with a 1,000-year flood, 600 people left homeless. Thankfully, no one died. But just shortly after that, then an F4 tornado went through a small town just outside of town and just obliterated it, killing over 20 people. And we had the opportunity to help those people as the Lord's church. In fact, you know, pretty much all the religious organizations were trying to help. You know, they guided by those principles that Christ set. You know, everybody that kind of looks to those principles is going to have these kind of benevolent attitudes within their lives. Thanks to help from disaster relief, which relies upon people giving, right? Good Christian people giving. And sometimes people that aren't even Christians give to disaster relief in Nashville. They gave us nearly $500,000 worth of supplies to give to people. $500,000. We didn't ask anything from anybody. We just offered it. We were there to help in time of need. And not only did we get the help from them, but we got money just mailed to us by individual Christians and by churches to the tune of somewhere around $10,000 or $15,000 in cash that was sent to us and said, just give this to help people that are hurting. And we used that money. We had one church came, brought their check. I forget how much it was. But they also brought all these big, when the tornado came, they brought, this is the night of, it happened earlier, and they were there within hours. And they had these big plates of turkey sandwiches, the big round ones, you know. And they said, you know, take these and give to those people. We know y'all are going into that area tomorrow. And so we cut them up and wrapped them up, and we took those sandwiches that those people thought about. You know, those people are going to be hungry. And that was a hit. Man, I tell you what, those people were hungry. And we didn't have sandwiches very long. Because, you know, once they saw we were giving out something to eat, people came. They were hungry. They'd lost everything, and food was so valuable at that moment that they wanted that. And so, you know, the Christian kindness there seen quickly by people. We helped over 500 families, and I'm blessed to have been a part of that. But also, we think about not only our charitable aspects that would be lost if Christ had never been born. Imagine all of that gone. All the people that would have suffered and died because no one was there. Children's homes. You ever thought about that? How many children Christians have taken in and helped to raise? You know, Christ-believing people have been caring for orphans for centuries when no one else cared. See, let me tell you how the orphan home began. I think you'll find this interesting. In the Roman world, it wasn't a lot different than today in regards to things like abortion, except they didn't have the medical means to do things like we do today in regards to those things. So if they had a child that was unwanted, specifically ladies, girls, sorry, it's just the way the world was. We're going to talk about that here in a moment if I can move faster. Because Jesus Christ did more for women than any person ever in history. But if they had a girl, she was worthless. couldn't raise much. She couldn't make any money. So what they do is they take her out into the woods and leave her to die. And that was considered a good thing. You were a good person not to bring another mouth to feed into this world. You know, it was honored. Christians fought this and would literally follow people into the woods. And when they left, they would take that baby home and raise it. And it was such an epidemic as far as the numbers that were being done. Eventually, it became hard to find individual Christians that could take in a bunch. So they began to work to take care of groups of them. They'd get them and bring them. And lo and behold, the ancestor to the modern day orphanage or children's home. But it began with Christians reaching out to help those babies that no one wanted. And they didn't have to, you know? It wasn't their baby. But it was a soul that they loved. And they saw that was because of Jesus Christ. Yes, ma'am. Trevor and Angela, Trevor and Angela Bruff and Miami, Oklahoma, wonderful, wonderful people, were not able to have children, but they adopted a beautiful young girl, baby girl from China, and I got to see her last spring, and she's growing up to such be a beautiful child and such a sweet girl. But they said when they got there and saw the conditions these children were living in, these small 1.5, 2-year-old babies sleeping on cardboard in just a room full of them, and no one really caring for them. They said it broke their hearts, and they said they wanted to go back and get more. And I said, that's a Christian. That's the love of Christ for individuals. That's what we have received because of Christ. I had the blessing of working with Pineville Children's Home when I first started preaching, and in the Pineville Children's Home, I saw children that had been terribly mistreated, but they were loved there, and were taken care of. James chapter 2 and verse 27 says, "Pure and undefiled religion in the sight of God and Father is this, to visit the orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself unstained by the world." Prior to Jesus, there is little trace of any kind of organized charitable effort to help anybody. I mean, you just look at your history. Prior to Christianity, there was nothing. Yes, individuals cared. There were individuals out there that helped. You can probably find instances of that, but there was not any organized effort to help people. There's not any large group that sought individuals to help people. The last Roman emperor to oppose Christians, Julian, said this, "For it is disgraceful that when no Jew has ever had to beg, and the impious Galileans," that's his word for Christians, "the impious Galileans support both their own poor and ours as well, all men see that our people lack aid from us." He said, it's a shame. The people we persecute are taking care of they care about our sick and our poor more than we do. Christians have had an impact in this area of the world. Christ did not exist, it would all be lost, not exist. No other large-scale movement has existed that even compares to the care and help that Christ-believing people have provided. So when we think about something to believe in, that's one thing to think about, the impact that Christianity has in general in our physical things of our world. Also, I said a while ago, we talk about women. Women's rights. What has Christ done? Christ having come to this earth, what did that do for women's rights? People actually today speak of Christianity as trying to destroy women's rights. In actuality, no one has done more for women than Jesus. Jesus' time, women were looked down. We're looked at as people who were down around the dogs. Women were nothing more than possessions that men had, abused, and threw away at will. We still see that in some cultures today, where women are still treated in this kind of way. Men did not associate with them publicly. Religious teachers had nothing to do with them whatsoever. Yet Jesus was different, wasn't he? He went against the societal norms and treated women with the same love and kindness that he treated men. Think about his mother. You realize it wasn't Joseph that God chose. It was Mary. See, it began with the choice of a woman. The woman who said, even though I don't understand how I'm going to get pregnant when I'm a virgin, behold the bondservant of the Lord. That's a beautiful woman right there. And she endured that shame that would come having been pregnant before marriage, that she might serve God. And so, and when we go forward to John chapter 2 and the turning of the water to wine, I love that interaction between Jesus' and mother. It's a great interaction. Because she comes up to him and says, hey, they're out of wine, Jesus. I'm being accommodative, but you can read it. They're out of wine, Jesus. He goes, I'm not in charge of that. What's that have to do with me? She goes, he says, it's not my time for, this is not what I'm here. It's not ready. It's not time for me to do these kind of things. And she just ignores him. You know, I've said things to my mother, and she did the same thing. Like, Mama, that turned around, walk off. And, that, you know, she didn't even hear what I said. Or she heard, she just didn't care. But Mary doesn't even acknowledge him. He says, I ain't doing that. She goes, she just turns to her and goes, do what he says, and walks off. And you know what? Jesus does it. Because when my mama doesn't acknowledge it, I do it too. Because I know what not acknowledging it means, right? She doesn't approve of what I said. And so, it's a wonderful interaction between Jesus and his mother. And he was the son. He was the oldest son. His father's gone. He did not have to listen to a word his mother said. He was the man of the house, literally, in Jewish society. He led the house. He could have told her, go away. But he didn't. He honored his mother. And he showed great love toward her. I think about Mary and Martha. And look over to Luke chapter 10 and verses 38 through 42, where it says, now as they were traveling, he entered a village, and a woman named Martha welcomed him into her home, and she had a sister named Mary who was seated at the Lord's feet listening to his word. But Martha was distracted with all her preparations, and she came up to him and said, Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to do all the serving alone? Then tell her to help me. But the Lord answered and said to her, Martha, Martha, you are worried about so many things, but only one thing is necessary, for Mary has chosen the good part, which shall not be taken away from her. See, Martha's in there. She's busy in the kitchen, right? She's the Martha Stewart of the New Testament. She's in there cooking and she's making little flowers or whatever. She's in there busy. And Mary's sitting at the feet of Jesus. That we can't walk past, right? Because most teachers in the Jewish law would not even allow a woman to be in the room while they're teaching. And she's sitting at his feet. She's right next to him. Martha comes out, and most Jewish men would have been, yeah, if it's going to get my meal on the table faster, get out of here, Mary, go fix my supper. Not Jesus. Jesus telling Martha, Martha, you shouldn't even be in there cooking right now. You should be in here listening too. Dinner can wait, right? Dinner's about Jesus and his eating, but this is about them. He says, she is getting something that cannot be lost, and you need it as well. We go all the way forward to John chapter 11, and even when we think more about Mary in Mark chapter 14, verses 3 through 9, that night, we're in the week, it's the week that Jesus dies, and Martha, or Mary rather, anoints his head with the expensive perfume in preparation for his death, and they all look down on her. They talk an awful to her. And Jesus said, what are you doing? She's doing something good for me. And as a result, Jesus said, I will memorialize her for all time. That when the gospel's preached, it will be preached and they will talk about her. And what are we doing this morning? We're talking about her 1,983 years later. Because Jesus said that. Because he cared about women. John chapter 11, these same two women, he raises their brother Lazarus. He tells them wonderful things. They run out to him, they hug him, they grab him, they tell him, Lord, if you'd been here, he wouldn't have died. And Jesus said, I'm the resurrection and the life. Do you believe that? And, oh, yes, Lord, we believe that. They understood things better than the disciples many times. Think about the woman at the well. Now, she was three times as bad as all other women, right? I mean, women were bad. But this woman was really bad, okay? She was a woman. That's strike one. She was Samaritan. I mean, strike two. And as if you couldn't get any lower, she was also an adulterous woman living with a man she wasn't married to. Okay, so probably the reason she's coming to the well by herself, because all the other women would have had nothing to do with her. And yet Jesus talks to her and gives her some of the most profound teachings about worship that you will ever read. And you know who is one of the biggest proclaimers of Jesus Christ? Her. She goes back to the village, says, there's a man out here that told me everything about me, right? And she brought the whole village out to Jesus. That's when Jesus made that great statement, the fields are white for harvest. We need to send forth reapers. Here they come. Boys, get ready. We got an opportunity because of what that awful woman did. No, Jesus didn't say that. Because of that wonderful woman. You know, you even think about the woman, the widow's mite. She was poor. That made her bad. She was a woman that made her bad. Jesus said that she was really the only one that really gave that day. Because she gave everything. What about Mary Magdalene? Seven demons cast out of her, but yet, who's at the cross? Mary Magdalene. Who's at the tomb Sunday morning? Mary Magdalene. See, Jesus made women a part of His ministry. They took care of Him, they supported Him, but they also were a powerful part of His teaching as well. And that made an impact on the centuries. Even after we go to the early church, we see women like Lydia and Priscilla. Paul would often take note of Christian women in his letters. And we look at Ephesians chapter 5, I'm having to speed up here a little bit because I've been going slow. I always think I don't have enough notes to go through class, and then I always have more than I should. Ephesians 5:20, beginning with verse 22, he's actually talking about the church, but he's comparing it to marriage. Now this is where we get so many people attacking us, right? We're barbaric that we would ask a woman to subject herself to her husband. How barbaric, as one of our former presidents had to say about us. Let me tell you what, you read all of that chapter. Don't just read that one verse. Men, it says, love your wives as your own self. You know what that means? Get rid of all the selfishness. She's as important as you are. You are to love her as you love your own body. You are to love her as you love her own self. A man who will lead in the home for the sole purpose of bringing good to his wife as he would want good for his own life. This is not oppressive. This is true and powerful love at work. This is sacrificial love at work. And I think that is what most women want and few women find. It's Christ's love in her husband. I don't have a problem subjecting myself to Christ because you know why? Because He loves me. And a wife shouldn't have any trouble subjecting herself to a husband that loves her like Christ loves us. He will do everything in the world for her. He will dote on her. He will give her the world because He loves her. That is what women want. And that is not oppressive, and that is not harsh, and that is not holding women down. That is having a man that will raise them up. Just as Christ raises us up every day. And that is what Christianity has provided for women. You know, we could talk about morality. You know, our laws in our nation are based upon the teachings of the Bible. I don't think any of us want to see murder, rape, dishonesty, assault, immorality in general, just let loose. But yet all of those laws that guard us and safeguard us from those things are laws based in Scripture. Where do you think those things became wrong? You know, man just didn't decide one day, hey, I think I'm going to make these things wrong. There's a reason why those things have been considered wrong, because they have been considered wrong by God from the very beginning. God has set that forth. And our laws have been built upon that. And it is laws that make society a safer place for us and for our children to grow up in. Someone might ask, what about the atrocities of Christianity? The Crusades or the Inquisitions. Well, I would say that that's not Christianity. You know, if someone goes out tomorrow and commits crimes, killing people, and everybody that they kill, they tell somebody standing nearby, hey, I'm whatever your name is. They tell them they're you. I'm Tom Genduso. I just killed a bunch of people. Does that make Tom guilty of what they did just because they used his name? Just because people use the name Christian doesn't mean it has anything to do with Christianity. We'll address that a little more in the sermon this morning. Jesus Christ has made the world a far better place for us to live in. Most of the ways He made it better, we take for granted because we have known nothing else for all of our lives. Jesus is something worth believing in, worth giving your life to. Such a belief truly saves the world. You know, people are out to save the world, aren't they? Recycle your can so you can save the world. Jesus really does save the world from itself, from its own bad choices. And such a belief will help children, will help the sick, will help the poor, will help the abused and hurt. It will help everybody. And this is not something that cannot be proven. The proof of this is in the last 2,000 years. Just look back. Check out the world before Christ and the world shortly after Christ. And you're going to see a profound change taking place. And that change just only got better as years went by. Such a belief, though, comes with standards. And it is those standards of behavior and life that cause Christians to do all these things. These standards are given to us in the Bible and shown in the life of Jesus Christ Himself. See, Christians don't just do this out of a vacuum. We do this because we have given our lives to be something else, to be like someone, to be like Jesus Christ, imitate Him, to hold His standards. And when we hold His standards, then we are these kind of people. He is the one thing to believe in. He is the only thing that you can believe in that will continue when we die and even when this earth is long gone. Those who obey Him will be with Him for all eternity, and nothing else has that kind of power to impact our personal lives and to impact the lives of everybody around us. I've seen people die with no understanding or hope about what will happen the minute they breathe their last. And it's a time of panic. It's a time of incredible, just unstoppable fear of the unknown. Then I've stood at the bed of a Christian who said, I've had a good long life. I think I'll just go home. And watch them die with a calm and a peace that I can't even begin to comprehend. That's the difference Christ living on this earth makes. The difference in people's lives personally and the difference in our world as a whole. Thanks be to God that He lived, that He died, and that He arose so that we can have these wonderful things in our world. Appreciate your good attention this morning.